It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook just...
Welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game and Bruce Devlin. Today we have our second left-handed golfer that's been on the show, but I think he also gets the prize for traveling the furthest distance to join us today.
There's no doubt about that, and what a great friend he's been for the last 50-odd years. I think the first time I ever met this gentleman was in 1959 in Johannesburg, South Africa. He and I were over there for the Commonwealth Games, him representing New Zealand and me Australia. And, of course, anybody that knows a little bit about golf knows who it is, and it is, in fact, Sir Robert Charles. Bob, thanks for joining us today, buddy. It's really nice to have you with us.
Well, it's a pleasure. Nice to chat with you all.
Bob, welcome to the show. And just so you know, you are now our 13th Golf Hall of Famer that's joined For the Good of the Game on our podcast. And it is a delight and a privilege to have you. As we've talked about before, we're here to tell your story. And there's a lot to tell because you've got a very accomplished list of things that you've been able to do in the game of golf. And I think we always like to start just as a young guy growing up in New Zealand. So maybe you can tell us about what life was like as a young lad growing up in Carterton, New Zealand.
Well, I never grew up in Carterton. I just happened to be born there. That was the nearest hospital where my mother could go to and get attended to for my birth. Wasn't Carterton. My dad was a country schoolmaster, and he was, well, at the time of my birth, he was in a place called Hinakura, which was, I suppose, about 20 miles from Carterton. And yes, Carterton was the place of my birth, but at that time, my parents were living in a country town of Hinakura, which is about 12 miles east of Martinborough, which is, Martinborough is only a small town in the Wairarapa province of the North Island of New Zealand. Well, actually, it's in the Wellington province. Wairarapa is in a valley. So my earliest recollections, I suppose, would be probably at the age of three, I think. In fact, I was in Martinborough from the age of, from birth to the age of four. My first recollection, although I don't remember too much about the age of three, is that I was playing outside under some trees near the house where we were living in, and I got attacked by a magpie. Obviously, the magpie was protecting its young, and so I was a good... getting a bit too close to the young. And so anyway, I was able to walk back into the house with blood streaming all over my head. Of course, I hardly remember it, but I have an aversion to magpies ever since. I know they're very common, prevalent in Australia, yeah. In Australia and New Zealand. So I've got them, a few of them on my farm, which I take pot shots with a slug gun occasionally. So anyway, that's my first recollections. And at the age of four, we moved into the Martinborough, which in modern day is very big in the grape industry, growing grape in the New Zealand wine industry. So I started school at the age of four, only because my birthday, is in March. So school starts in February. So I was started as a four-year-old a month before my fifth birthday. And who would be my first teacher ever was my dad. Not necessarily a country school, but it was a small school about 5 miles south of Martinborough, and I was there for probably a year during the war years. Of course, now we're talking about 1940, 1941. And the little story I tell there is that in the war years, everybody was digging air raid shelters. We were kind of in the firing line of Japan. We had Japanese submarines both in the area of Australia and New Zealand. New Zealand, I think they did fire a salvo from a submarine into Sydney in Australia, but New Zealand didn't get attacked in any shape or form. But we did. Everybody's home had. They dug an air raid shelter, which was pretty basic, and you know, a few groceries in, and not very deep. I don't think it could have withstood even a hand grenade, let alone a bomb. But the air raid at the school I was going to, Puranoa, it was they had two air raid shelters, and the instructions from the headmaster, I'd add, was you cannot walk on top of the air raid. They were covered, actually. You cannot walk on the top of the air raid shelters. And on one frosty winter morning, my dad looked out the window, saw three or four boys walking across the air raid shelters. So we were beckoned in. And I don't know whether we got six of the best. My dad was a very disciplinarian. And he used a razor strop. I don't. Yeah. Mike probably wouldn't be aware of what a razor strop is. They don't have them.
Actually,
they
I
have
am.
Them these days.
Oh, yes.
I don't know whether it was six of the best or just a gentle tap or what. But I remember that at the first school I went to, and then a tent when my dad actually was called up into the services, volunteer called up, I'm not sure which, into the army in 41. He was not teaching anymore, so I started going to the Martinborough School, which was within walking distance of where I was living at the time. And so dressed up in my Harris tweed jacket and my hobnailed boots, I walked to school every day. And the primers, as they were called, from, 5-year-old starting school. And, of course, my dad went away to, he started out in the army, was about to be drafted. His company or battalion, whatever, was about to leave for the Middle East. So the house which we were renting, my mother decided that she would become a caretaker for an elderly gentleman in Martinborough who happened to be the tobacco and newsstand, as it was called. They had a billiard table. He had a hair salon where he cut hair and sold the usual knickknacks in his store. We had accommodated upstairs, so I spent probably 4 years, 3 or 4 years, I suppose, during the war. And those were probably one of the happiest years of my life. Things were very quiet. Of course, the adults wouldn't have said that because we were living on coupons. You had coupons to have butter and coupons for sugar and coupons for meat. And it was frugal times, which I lived through, which I think was had some bearing on my upbringing to be, be careful.
Conservative.
spending money. But of course, I had a driveway down the side of the house, which I used as a cricket. I could bowl the cricket ball 22 yards, and I had. The other thing, I was an only child, so I didn't. I guess I was spoiled in some respect, although I was certainly disciplined with the. Spare the rod and spoil the child. My folks didn't they didn't spare the rod. So I was an only child, but I was in many ways spoiled, I suppose. I've always had my first recollection of I think it was a birthday gift or a Christmas gift, was a rugby football. And that was the I was able to kick the football in a paddock next to the house, and that was a lot of fun. But during that period, I acquired an interest in ball games. I played tennis on grass tennis courts. And, you know, I'm talking between the ages of 5 to 11, which I was spending in Martinborough. So that's from, 41 to 1941. And I had two old hickory-shafted clubs, a mashie and a mid-iron, and I would had a paddock nearby where I was able to go out and hit the first two clubs I ever owned were hickory. So I was couldn't have been happier with the opportunity to play tennis, play cricket, and hit golf balls. My rugby came to an end, I suppose, and at the age of 12, when I had a serious injury where I tore I was tackled with the ball carrying the football and went down, and my legs spread and I tore all the muscles in my groin. Worst part of that was that I was virtually an invalid for 3 months, could barely walk, and I missed most of the cricket season. So that was the end of rugby. And so right after this injury, I concentrated on golf in the winter. Golf, as you may not be aware, is a winter sport here. Well, I think in Australia and New Zealand.
Correct.
And cricket was my summer sport, and golf was my winter sport. So that was the, I'm taking you from the age of 5 through to 10. I didn't want for anything. I was reasonably warmly dressed in the winter, and although things were hard to get, the old O'Brien hobnailed boots, they were made to last. They were a daily. You got around in hobnailed boots. You know, what you think about it today, you wonder why would you ever do that? But that was the fashion in the day.
So, Bob, getting to the golf side of your career, we understand that you never ever had a lesson from a pro. So, who started you in the game? Who got you? Who really piqued your interest?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a 2 on a par 5 to win a 2-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
Well, you might say that the first golf course, I was wheeled around in a pram. Perambulated, as they call it in America, I'm not sure. But whilst they were living, my folks were, a baby in Henakura, shortly after I was born. We had, the local farmers put together a 9-hole golf course virtually right beside the house we were living in. And my mother and one of the farmer's wives had a baby, same age. So I was pushed around this 9-hole golf course. I suppose I wasn't breaking teeth at that stage. But the golf balls would have been in the pram and golf clubs would have been across the pram. And so that was my, I didn't know it, of course, but that was my introduction to golf. So anyway, my parents were both keen golfers. My mother started out as a right-handed golfer, and my dad was naturally a left-handed golfer, obviously, like myself. And when they moved into Martinborough, they joined the Martinborough Golf Club, and also they've been members of golf clubs right from day one, as far as I was concerned. So both my mother and father were very keen sportsmen. They loved their ball games. They loved their tennis. My mother didn't play cricket, but she really enjoyed her golf, she got down to a single-figure handicap. I think 8 was the lowest she got down to, and my dad got down to about a 2 handicap. So they were pretty useful golfers, and I guess they gave me an introduction to the game and also to other ball games as well. And of course, at my happiest when I'm competing with a ball game on my farm out here. And well, I'm 50 miles from my farm right now, near Oxford in New Zealand. I have a croquet court, I have a tennis court, I have a billiard table and a ping pong table, and I'm at my happiest when I'm playing or competing in any one of those sports.
That was why he was tough on the golf course, Mike. Did you get that message, why he was so tough on the golf course?
Yeah, and as you know, many of our guests have talked about the same thing, being multi-sport athletes, ball games, developing hand-eye coordination at a very young age.
Yeah, well, you could call me a ball freak if you like. Obviously inherited it from my parents. And my dad retired after 40 years in the teaching profession. My folks spent most of their lives renting houses. My dad was in a profession where he could be moved around the country as a teacher. And so it wasn't until he retired, well, at the age of 58, he started teaching when he was 18 and retired 40 years later when he was 58. And they built their first house, which my dad had saved enough money to be able to build a house in his retirement, which happened to be within walking distance of the Christchurch Golf Club, where we as a family all came to in 1956. And I, of course, was a 20-year-old then. Joined the Christchurch Golf Club. And so both my parents spent a lot of the time, their retirement years, on the Christchurch Golf Club playing this great game of golf.
So, Bob, the other difference between you growing up in New Zealand is the fact that you didn't get the intense golf through a university, like a lot of the Americans have. You went into the banking business, right? You were a teller at your young age.
Well, yes, and the only reason I got into the bank, when I finished high school, it took me 5 years to get through high school. I spent an extra year to get a school certificate. I was not a good student. I was a very poor student. I didn't believe in homework. I doubt whether I spent more than a couple of hours of homework. And this is, you know, the son of a school teacher. And my dad didn't actually believe in homework anyway. He taught in school during between 9 and 3 o'clock. And when that 3 o'clock bell went, not only did the kids out there on the playing fields, but my dad was out there with them, coaching them in rugby and teaching them cricket and that. He did not believe in homework, and I spent, obviously you got to put a little bit of time in, which I didn't. and all I was interested in was getting out on the golf course and or the playing fields. So my education was somewhat neglected, and so at the age of 17, coming up on 18, I had no idea what the future held for me. I had no ambitions whatsoever, no job prospects. I didn't have the exam marks or to go to university. You had to have a certain level of education to get into that. So I just happened to be, at the age of late 17, I happened to be playing a round of golf with the local bank manager of the National Bank. His name was Ron Strawn. And I guess it came up in conversation as to what I was going to do, leaving high school. And he said, well, why don't I give you a job as a junior in the bank? And so I said, well, it's one way of earning money, I suppose. And the other great thing about in the bank in those days, the doors closed at 3 o'clock, as did school. And as long as you'd balance the books, I could be on the golf course by 4 o'clock.
Yeah, perfect.
In the summertime, I spent hours and hours on the golf course. So the 7 years I spent in the bank were very pleasant years. I enjoyed the work. But it did give me a huge opportunity to develop my golfing skills after hours at work. In fact, my banking career ended when I spent the 7 years in the bank, I spent, I think 3 years in Masterton, which was in the Wairarapa, where my first 20 years were spent. My dad was moved from a Masterton school. He got a job as the headmaster at the Kashmir School here in Christchurch. And so I moved with him down here at the time and moved with the bank. I had a move in the bank to the National Bank of New Zealand here in Christchurch. So I spent 4 years before I turned pro. And, of course, during those years, I had the opportunity of, my first international, leaving New Zealand was in 1956. At the age of 20, I, together with a golfing friend, John Durry, who was actually in the team, Bruce would remember John from the sure. New Zealand team at the Commonwealth Golf Tournament in Johannesburg. We got accepted as entrants into a Palaco, in Australia, I'm talking about, Palaco tournament in Sydney at the Australian Golf, Australian Golf Club, and the Ampol tournament in Melbourne at Yarra Yarra. So that was my first trip overseas. I played in the two tournaments. I didn't make the cut in either, but it was my first international experience. I watched Bo Weiniger was playing. George Baer, one of the longest hitters in the game at that time, was playing from the United States, Florrie Van Dock from Belgium. Gary Player, Harold Henning, and Trevor Wilkes were from Australia. So I was rubbing shoulders with these, they were pretty much young pros at that time. And so it was a great experience. And, of course, need I say that Gary won the Ampol tournament, his first ever win, and of course that was he was able to go back to South Africa and marry his childhood sweetheart,
right,
Vivian.
Yeah.
Whom we just lost.
So I'm a little I'm a little emotional now, but I'll get over that. Yes. So that was my first venture overseas to Australia. We were there for about 2 or 3 weeks, I suppose, just playing in 2 tournaments. After I came back, I was invited by a golfing friend by the name of Ian Crom, a member of the Christchurch Golf Club, and he invited me to join him on a trip virtually around the world in 1958, starting in January of 1958. And the trip started off with, 4 months in the United States and about 3 months in the UK. Prior to departing on this trip, I had written a letter to Clifford Roberts at Augusta and put my,
your CV, your curriculum vitae?
CV, that's the word I'm looking for, which was included the New Zealand Open, which I had won 4 years earlier as an 18-year-old amateur. And in those days at Augusta, they were looking for international golfers. Mm-hmm. I think they must have pricked their attention that, never heard of anybody from New Zealand. And so anyway, I got a lovely invitation from Clifford Roberts. I've still got the letter signed by him to inviting me to the Masters in 1958. So I'm getting kind of ahead of myself, I suppose, in a way. But 1958, as I said, I spent 7 months out of New Zealand, traveling the world, living out of a suitcase. I played in three majors, which was the Masters, the British Open, and the British Amateur. So it was this trip which set me up really for a future in professional golf. And then my next international trip was to South Africa in 1959 for the Commonwealth Tournament. And then I also went to Marion in 1960, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1960.
Yeah, 60.
Yeah.
When Jack Nicklaus
broke Hogan's record.
Did this incredible, incredible scoring round the. That's right. I'm getting back to when I turned pro. So after that trip into Marion, I came back and the bank manager said, we want to send you to Wellington, giving me kind of a little bit of a, what should we say, hopefully a lift in salary and to train me to be, a career in banking. And so I, it didn't take me too long to think about it, which meant that, I'm going to be away from home, going to be away from the Christchurch Golf Club, sending me. It was an either or situation. Either I continue a future in banking or my future's in golf. So having made these international trips and had all the experience in playing against the best players in the world and the greatest tournaments in the world, it was really a no-brainer for me to give it a shot and turn pro, which I did in October of 1960.
Boy, what a great decision.
If I can, let's just double back on a few things that you went over. It'd be interesting, I think, for our listeners to understand how your golf game developed as a young man, because as Bruce brought up earlier, you didn't really have the benefit of a normal, regular coach, I don't think. Did you learn the game more from observation or from reading?
Well, a combination of both, I suppose. Ben Hogan's Power Golf was, I suppose, my golfing Bible. And I don't know that I actually read the whole book. All I did was look at the pictures. They were, of course, in black and white. And I spent, well, I don't know now exactly, but hours looking in front of a mirror in my mother's dressing in their bedroom. They had a large mirror. And I would have the book in front of me, and I'd make kind of practice swings in front of the mirror, trying to replicate Hogan's swing. So, yeah, Hogan was, he wasn't really a mentor, but his book certainly inspired me. And his golf swing, and of course, I even say today that he was the greatest player that ever lived. And you can talk about Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods, but to me, Ben Hogan was the greatest golfer that ever lived. And interestingly, well, I'm getting way ahead now. Interestingly, and I'm very sad to learn this morning that the Oakland Hills clubhouse has been burnt to the ground, and it was here at Oakland Hills in 1965, I think it was, had the pleasure of playing with Ben Hogan and witnessed the greatest round of golf I've ever witnessed playing with Ben. He shot 67 or 68, I think it was. He must have been in his 50s at the time. What in 65, how old was Hogan?
Yeah, that's about right.
He would have been in his 50s, and I mean, he just virtually hit every fairway, hit every green, and he had, well, you can see me, obviously, he had the shakes in his hands. Bruce, you played with him, yeah, and he probably had the shakes.
I did.
I had, I think, four rounds of golf with him. I played with him at, not Shady Oaks, Dallas. But anyway, he couldn't keep his hand still with the putter. With a long game, the hands were on the club and they didn't move. But with the putter, he had the shakes. He never missed a putt under 10 feet. It's the most amazing round of golf I've ever seen. And that's why I think he's the greatest of them all. I think he was the nearest anybody came to perfecting a mechanical golf swing. Not that it was mechanical, it was just amazing. So, where were we? Yeah, we're talking about...
You just turned pro, buddy.
Oh, my getting Hogan's book, the golf club in Marston, where I was, I lived very close to, nearby, and had the great opportunities of getting out on. There was no professional at the Marston Golf Club. I just had the opportunity of spending hours and hours on the golf course in all kinds of weather, rain, shine, wind, whatever. And, I didn't read much. Well, yes, now you can't see, but I'm in my, office library. My top wall. Can I move this?
Maybe. Sure, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, can you see? Can you see up on the top there? Can you see the green book?
Yep.
Yes.
I've got from the green, this is Golf World, goes back to 1954. Now, virtually my whole record is in these books, Golf World. I've had them all bound. And I started subscribing in 1954, and so I was up to date from then of everything that happened on the U.S. tour. And I knew the names of everybody. Of course, there was very little instruction in Golf World. It was, it started out as a very small it was a weekly publication, and I'm very sad to, it's now digital, and so which is sad, because I've got these volumes about a whole wall of the Golf World. But that also inspired me, I suppose, and encouraged me to, well, one of these days, you know, I'd love to go and play on the U.S. tour.
Yeah.
So, no, there was no pro at the golf club. In short order, I suppose, I became probably the best golfer in the club by the age of 17. Of course, going back a step, at the age of 15, you had to be 15 years of age before you could join the golf club. You know, I'm talking about the days of young kids should be seen and not heard, and
right.
You know, there was no great encouragement for young golfers whatsoever. So I joined the club at the age of 15 and played in my first tournament at 16 with my mother, mixed foursome, which we got beaten in the final. I played my first 72-hole event at the age of 17. I was down on a plus handicap at the age of 17. So I virtually picked the game up myself. I had no mentors to, you know, tell me to do this or that and work on the grip and the stance. The question you asked about instruction and a professional, I relate, I've had two lessons in my life from professionals. I'm not sure whether I actually paid for them or not. But the first lesson was well into my, in 1966, 6 years into my career. I'm playing at the Beverly Country Club in Chicago, Western sure. Open. And I was having a bad year in 1966 and missing cuts and not making much money. So my problem was my tee shots. My preferred draw was turning into a duck hook, and duck hooks can be rather costly and expensive, as you can imagine. So I sought out Bob Toski and said, "Bob, can you just come and see me hit a few balls on the range and give me see if I can, you know, straighten out the duck hook to a slight draw." So we go down to the range and he said, "Grab a club," and I grabbed the club. And as soon as I grabbed the club, I hardly grabbed the club, and he put his hand out and he grabbed the club and he yanked at it, and it was like in a vice. I had this club in a vice. He said, "There it is." He said, "You're gripping a club too tight." And he said, loosen up the grip. And right from then on, I certainly got rid of the duck hook, and that helped considerably. The second lesson I got was from David Ledbetter. By now, let's see, must have been about 48.
I was going to say, you're getting close to being a senior with David Ledbetter.
Getting close. So I had lost my card. I was on the regular tour, and I'd been playing the European tour. I played the European tour 10 years prior to, for 14 years prior to joining the senior tour. But during that time, they had could almost call it a second tier events in the United States. And I was over there playing in a few of them. There was only about six or eight tournaments, and I happened to play in them. And it was during that time I was having problems, and I booked I wasn't living in
Palm Beach, was it?
No. It, it, Well, still on the road, doesn't matter. But he was, I drove up, I think, from somewhere in Florida to, was it Greenleaf? Was he at Greenleaf in Orlando? Anyway, went into his office and we started talking about the game. And I spent an hour, more than an hour, in his office. Never went outside, never hit a ball. We just talked about the mental side of the game.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, the next week I'm playing in the Tallahassee Open, and who wins? I went from virtually an hour in David Ledbetter's office to a tournament and win it. They were both very good lessons, and I guess it's a good lesson for anybody is don't grip the club too tight. Just have it so that you don't destroy the feel. And the other lesson is the mental side of the game is just as important as the physical side.
That win you referenced, Bob, I think came in 1983. I want to take you 25 years prior to that. I want to take both of you back to 1958. That's when you both traveled to the Old Course in St. Andrews for the Eisenhower Trophy. Of course, the Aussies prevailed, as you probably remember. You both did quite well as individuals, but what are your recollections of Bobby Jones's involvement as the honorary U.S. captain and then giving that famous speech?
Well, it was we attended the when he got the
key to the city.
The key to the city. I mean, it was a very moving occasion, and I don't think there were too many dry eyes in the house. Well, there was obviously a lot of people, and at university. It was in the I just forget the name of it, but it was Jones, of course. We all know about his history and record and what he did at St. Andrews. He went back, just after the war years, didn't he? And
correct.
Played in a uniform, as far to the best of my knowledge, an army uniform. No, he was in. What was he in the army?
Sure,
but that was a great occasion, and of course he was suffering immensely from his disability, and it was the inaugural Eisenhower World Team Championship. Do they still call it the Eisenhower?
Yeah, they do. Eisenhower.
They do. Yeah. So from my personal perspective, it was my second visit to St. Andrews. My first visit was for the British Amateur in June, I think it was, that same year, 58. And I had my first look at the Old Course was from a train window with Bobby Vevey, the South African, and I had traveled by train from London to St. Andrews. I think the train arrived in the station at 6 o'clock, and we were on the golf course by 7 o'clock, and we finished a 3.5 hour round from 7 o'clock till 10:30. Most magnificent day you could imagine, nothing but blue sky, no wind, and a perfect introduction for me personally to the Old Course. And of course, I've had a love affair for the Old Course ever since. I think it's the greatest course that in the game, because it's unique with its seven double greens. It's you can play it clockwise or anti-clockwise, and in fact, one of my wish lists is to play it clockwise. But I don't know that that's going to happen, because they only allow it, I think, for a matter of a couple of days a year now. So, of course, I got through to the quarterfinal. Alan Thirlwall beat, I think he was the final. Joe Carr won the amateur that year. I think he beat Alan Thirlwall, who beat me in the quarterfinal. So when we got there for the Eisenhower, later in the year, probably October, was it?
Yeah.
I think.
Yes, it was.
I was certainly very well acquainted with the old course, and what few people will remember is that New Zealand was leading with one round to go, and we were all excited about that. I don't know whether we had a 1-2 or what shot lead, but obviously the with the three contenders were the UK, the USA, and Australia. And in that final round, it was not the easiest, quite windy, I think, and cold in October, obviously. And John Durry, one of the team members, took a 10 on the road hole.
Oof.
Whereas if he'd taken, I think if he'd taken a 6, just a bogey, we would have won.
That's right.
And I went out and had a round of 36. I had 40 shots to the green and 40 putts. 40 for 80. 40. John Durry shot 80, and I think we both shot 80. And if I'd had something like 36 putts, we would have won. Of course, one of my my 40 putts, my 38th putt was from the road on the last hole. I set a drive on the road, and I was so aggravated with my putter, I said, I don't care if you break hitting it off the car, it's a sealed road. So I hit the putter and whacked it on the green, 2 more putts, so that was a drive and a 3 putt, a par on the last hole for 80.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for 2, but it bounced off 9. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.